Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Carol Bannons. Carol Bannons helps individuals navigate their grief and reclaim their lives through her CHOOSE program, empowering them to move forward with confidence while maintaining a meaningful connection to their loved ones. As a certified grief educator and grief to gratitude coach, Carol offers compassionate support with practical tools, guiding grievers to rediscover purpose and joy. Her transformative journey began with the loss of her husband in 2018, leading her to a profound exploration of grief that uniquely shaped her approach to helping others. Carol is also an Amazon number one selling author of the grief poetry book, Kintsugi Your Heart, The Art of Living with Grief. And with that, Carol, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dave. Thank you so much. And you got all that pronunciation correct as well.
That's good. I try to be mindful of getting pronunciation right. I kind of figure one of the worst ways to get off on the wrong foot with a guest is to mispronounce their name.
You got it right.
Or to mispronounce the title of their book. So I wanted to make sure that I had all of that in place and, you know, rehearse it a couple times before we went live. So, but we met, I think, initially it was through a gentleman, I think by the name of Keith McNally. Am I correct?
Right. We did.
Yeah. Keith has this knack for bringing like-minded individuals together. He's one of many individuals that have referred really, really great guest contributors to the podcast. And with Keith and other individuals that are in his circle and those that I've developed on my own, I haven't had to look too far for guests. So that's
a wonderful connector, I have to say. Yes, I'm very grateful to him.
Yep. And, you know, some people are born natural connectors, and he is one of those. So
I think so. Yeah.
So anyway, if you're ready, I've got questions.
Go ahead.
All right. The first question for you is, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
Well, I start from the beginning. From a young girl in England, I came from a medical family. My dad was a surgeon, my mother was a nurse, and I grew up in a medical community. So I chose to become a physical therapist as I got older. But I also experienced grief as a young child. I think we're going to talk about that another time. But my sister died when I was 9 years old. So I grew up in the UK, and then I married an Australian, came to Canada. We have two children. We divorced. And then I married Brian, a jazz pianist. And unfortunately, he developed lung cancer, had a moment there, lung cancer in 2012. And we had a 6-year journey with that. And he died in 2018. And I loved my job as a physical therapist. I loved it. I mean, I came to Canada and everybody's changing careers here, there, and everywhere. There I was at 36 years in this profession that I love, but I couldn't put on that facade of being okay when I wasn't okay. And I tried to do that for 3 years, burnt out, and then decided, okay, I've got to leave. And so that led me on my own journey to becoming a grief coach. There in a nutshell.
Well, that's a very powerful nutshell. You went from mother to husband, to companion, to caregiver, and then to a grief coach. And that's quite a progression. But, you know, we never have control over the paths our lives are going to take. I've learned that through my own experiences with grief. As you know, during our pre-chat, I think we shared grief experiences and, you know, we share a cancer journey, albeit it's a little different. For me, it was the loss of a child over 21 years ago, my daughter Janine, and I call it transition to a new experience, a new dimension. She had a very aggressive form of cancer, and my life took a drastic turn. What I thought was going to be my life moving forward wasn't the life I ever envisioned, but it's a life now that I'm blessed to have been able to embrace. And I think, like yourself, we can do some great work helping individuals who are going through some serious life transitions.
I think so. And I think, you know, I mean, nobody really, I don't think, grows up saying, I think I'm going to go into grief as a career. Maybe some do, but I think in general, I found that most people that are counselors, supporters, coaches, therapists are there because for grief, are there because they even have had that experience. And that lived experience gives you that insight to help others on a different level, I think.
Yeah, and I think it unlocks a lot of different qualities in us that were either dormant or that we never knew that we had. For lack of a better way to put this, there are blessings as a result of the challenges we go through with losses that, you know, we access different parts of ourselves that we never thought could be accessed, or we access them because it's a necessity for us moving forward if we're going to re-engage in life again.
I think so. And I think it's surprising because really, even early in grief, I mean, first of all, early in grief, you don't know even how you're going to put one step in front of the other, do you? And I don't think you realize that there is this opportunity, if you are going to allow and open yourself up to it, be able to support others. And it can be in small ways. It doesn't have to be as we're doing it, but volunteering or whatever. But I mean, I never wrote poetry. Where did that come from? Where does this growth come from, this post-traumatic growth that we can have? And the thing is, I want people to know, is that not everybody's going to have it, and that's okay too. But for some of us, we are fortunate enough to find these different things that we have that we didn't have access to, that grief has peeled away a layer and allowed us to get to. And that is a blessing.
Agreed. And one of the things I really love to do whenever I'm talking to somebody who's experienced a life-altering loss is to have that person tell me about the person that they've lost, because I think it's important that the audience get to know who you lost through your eyes. So with that introduction, I'm going to ask you if you would to please tell our audience about Brian.
Oh my gosh, Brian Brown, jazz pianist extraordinaire who studied with Oscar Peterson. We had a big age difference. We fell in love. And music was such a big part of our lives. He would play gigs four times a week. Every year we do a big gig at the National Arts Center here in Ottawa, and the tickets sell out. He was masterful at piano. And he had a great sense of humor. And so what I find now, which is really interesting, I hear something and think, oh, Brian told me that, or I should have listened better, you know. He was magnificent at the piano, and he was music. And quite often he'd sit down and play something and say, okay, now you do that. And I'd say, okay, well, play it again. And he'd play something totally different. And I'd say, well, that's what you just played. He's like, oh, played it again, different again. He was a jazz pianist, not like my classical upbringing of this is what it is. And he had this ability to reach into your heart with his music, to touch your soul. He had such a good sense of humor. So many Brian Brown stories from people after he died that were so beautiful and kept his spirit alive. And his spirit is so alive for me through his music. Having said that, it was hard to listen to his music in those early years. I couldn't stand it because he was his music. And so it would break my heart all over again as I listened to it. But he was an interesting character. He was, oh my goodness, I mean, he went on his own journey. He used to play in all these jazz clubs. He was alcoholic. I didn't know him then. Smoked all sorts of interesting drugs. Again, I got him when he was mellow. And he had beaten all of that. He'd gone through all of that. to the place where he was now. And somebody made a really interesting comment when he was playing one time. He said, you know, with Brian, there's always a slight melancholy in his music that runs through. And I thought, yeah, I think that's true. I think that's his life experience. And he wouldn't have played the way he played unless he had lived the life he'd lived. So he was a big character, an interesting character, very generous, a very generous person musically when he supported others as, you know, backing and helping them. And I miss him dreadfully. He was a very special man.
And I had the opportunity to find some of his older music on YouTube. And if you go on YouTube and just Google the Brian Brown Trio, there's a whole bunch of, I know he did some jazz specials in Canada. He was featured quite prominently, and his piano work is just masterful. I mean, it's very soothing, but you're right. I could see where you can detect a hint of melancholy in his music, but I think the great musicians channel their life experiences, both good and bad, into their music. You know, the musicians that I like, and I'm not a jazz aficionado, but the music that I like, the artists that I appreciate, are those that have used their life experiences, particularly their challenging life experiences, to create a very powerful and impactful message with their music. Yeah. And that, to me, is where music becomes it is a creative form of expression. But when a person's life experiences are part of that, it takes that creativity up a notch, and it makes the music impactful and something where the message of that song or the music is going to last long after that person leaves this world.
I think so. And I think the other thing I would say about music for Brian is that he had this cancer journey, and he kept performing until about three or four months before he died. And I think that's what kept him going. I think that love, that joy from the music of sharing it with others, that's the best medicine he could have had. I truly believe that music is what kept him around for longer than he was supposed to be.
Well, and I think for individuals who are diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, I think attitude or motivation to defy the odds, I think, can increase our quality of life. Obviously, he wanted to remain engaged in life, and he did so with his music, and that gave him a longer end of life chapter, and it gave him an opportunity to create more memories during his end of life chapter for both you, for him, and those who listen to him. And you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about cancer, did you find that there was a grief before his actual death, that you were going through grief of a different form?
I don't think I knew it. I know that, you know, grief, when somebody's diagnosed with a terminal illness, now I know as a grief educator, that this is anticipatory grief. I was working full time with chronic pain patients. I was trying to manage Brian, taking him to the emergency room every few weeks, and radiation and all sorts and surgeries. I had a sick mother in the UK I was flying to and from. A sick friend with Alzheimer's selling his house. I didn't know if I was coming or going. And I know that people would say, I hope you're taking time for yourself. Or I just roll my eyes and say, are you kidding? I have no time, and I wish I'd listened to them and taken three breaths. But at the time, I don't really think I knew that I was grieving. I thought I was very prepared because we were very open, knew what was going to happen. We were very pragmatic, and even in the hospice, we were very pragmatic about everything. And I had no idea what this grief was going to be like. I did not realize how hard it would hit me. You know, when you organize the funeral, the order of service, blah, 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 all of this stuff, which we had the opportunity to do because it wasn't certain, you think, okay, well, I'll be sad. It's much more than that. And I didn't know. So, no, I'm not sure I really knew that I was grieving. Because he was so good. He was like a cat with nine lives. You know, he was a jazz pianist. He kept coming back. He kept coming back. Until if he didn't come back, we'd be in hospital. And he'd have the nurses and the doctors all around him chatting, telling, you know, he'd have oxygen on. He held court. So it never really seemed real that it was going to happen, even though I knew intellectually it was. And for me, I think what I grieved was when I noticed he'd go to the piano, because he could play anything in any key. And if a singer changed keys, he would just modulate and go with it. But he'd sit down one time and he was thinking about what to play. And then he'd play. He said, "You noticed a difference in my piano playing." And I said, "Well, yeah, I have. You're thinking about it." He said, "Yeah, it's a bit slower." It was that slowing down of, where am I going? What chord? That was never planned. That was the big thing for me I noticed. I think when you live with somebody and their health is declining very slowly over time, you don't really notice. And it's not till I go back and see photos and I'm like, oh my God, he'd lost so, you know, from 240 to 140, that's a big weight loss. And yet when you're there every day, it's so small, right? You don't notice it really. So no, I'm not sure that I really knew whether I didn't know if I was coming or going, honestly.
I think when you're right in the midst of it, when you're in the midst of caregiving, you're in the midst of just the cancer journey in and of itself, it's really in hindsight that we look back and said, yeah, I was grieving. You know, like for me with Janine, it was more obvious. I mean, and everybody's journey is different, but it was more obvious. I mean, at 18 years old, she was beginning to lose her physicality, her autonomy. She, you know, lost a lot of weight. And there were just some other things that were going on with her that the person that I knew was dying before my eyes. You know, her personality, her spirit. And that was before her actual physical death. And for me, I can remember as if it was yesterday, Carol, all of the milestone dates, the date that she was diagnosed, the date that she started chemo, the date that we were given a very poor prognosis for her long-term recovery, the day that she decided to quit treatment and request hospice. All of those days are etched into my memory. And I still remember the last day of her life very vividly. I remember who was there, the sounds, the sights, everything.
I remember I don't remember the dates, to be fair, but I remember the days and I remember how each of those days went. And I particularly, of course, remember the last few days and the very last day. Yes, it is etched in your mind and it's hard to take that picture away, isn't it?
It is. And the other thing is that these are all dates in addition to the traditional milestone dates that grief educators deal with. The dates of first diagnosis, the dates where they went into remission, the dates where the cancer came back. These are all dates that, you know, family members will grieve. And then we have to honor the grief for those dates as well as for just the milestone dates. And I think it also speaks to the fact that each cause of death, each dying trajectory that an individual takes has with it its own unique issues that we as grief educators, counselors, psychologists, social workers need to be aware of when we're dealing with grieving individuals.
Yeah, I think that's true. Everybody's journey is different. The journey to death is different, and the journey in grief afterwards is very different. So different. It's quite fascinating, really, as I do this more. And you see that it's people's life experiences leading up to that death that affect the way that they're going to grieve. Afterwards, I didn't know that. But
yeah, and how they handled previous losses, we could look at the strengths that they developed from previous losses and see how they can apply to their current situation. There's a whole variety of different factors which makes the grief journey so individualized. And I think if there's one message that we could give to individuals in society is that everybody grieves the same way. So don't expect that they're going to. Don't make them grieve the way that you think it's appropriate for them to grieve. Create space for the way they need to grieve and be present for it.
Totally. I know David Kessler says, first of all, your loss is the worst loss, so don't compare griefs. And I think, you know, it's so tempting, isn't it? Saying, well, you know, Sally down the road lost her husband and she's doing well. Why am I still like this? Well, maybe Sally had a different experience with her husband than you.
Yeah.
And all the life experiences. And I think it's, you know, when I coach one-on-one because I really truly believe each person has their own journey. And I find that hard to push into a group. Having done many groups in my life with back pain, there's always one person who wants to stand out or who has lots of questions and somebody who's quiet that doesn't get their needs met. And so for me personally, the coach, as a grief coach, I like to do that one-on-one. I find that that is the most helpful.
Absolutely. And if we can create space for everybody's individualized journey and work within how they choose to grieve, you know, we're golden. And we're going to help individuals move through their grief at their own pace.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, speaking of poetry, let's talk about your book. Your book of poetry is titled Kintsugi Your Heart, The Art of Living with Grief.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, tell our audience what kintsugi is and its applicability to reengaging in life after loss. Secondly, tell us about how the book is structured and what you want readers to take away from it.
Okay. Well, so I'm going to show you the picture. And so that people can see this heart put together with gold. So kintsugi is the Japanese art of putting together broken pots with gold. So I was thinking when I wrote the book, actually, it started by my writing a post. I wrote a post on Valentine's Day called Kintsugi Your Heart. I thought, oh, it's a great name for a book when I finally wrote all this poetry. So I think of kintsugiing your heart. The book is in three parts. Shattered, which is your heart. Your daughter died. My husband died. Our hearts are shattered into a million pieces. The next part of the book is just in pieces. So they're shattered, they're in pieces. But the last part of the book is called Making Broken Beautiful. How do we bring all those shattered pieces of our poor hearts together? It is different, but it can still be beautiful. So I talk about self-compassion, about allowing, about love, because these are the things we bring them together. And as I think now, I think of, you know, the memories of the gold that knit, weave our hearts together. Our loved ones, I feel, are always with us in our hearts. And I think they have kintsugied our hearts together. So that's where that came from.
I like the concept because I've always said I've equated grief in some ways to rebuilding the foundation of a house. Let's say you built a house 30 years ago and you build that foundation with specific materials. Well, 30 years later, when that foundation needs to be replaced, you're going to find that those materials that you used 30 years ago are outdated. So you have to use materials that are going to give you a solid foundation, albeit with different pieces. I look at grief as we rebuild the foundation of our lives with different tools, different skills that we did not think of acquiring pre-grief. Yeah. Our foundation is different because the materials are different, but it's stronger and it represents the life that we now need to re-engage in following catastrophic loss. So,
yes, I think so. I love that analogy as well. I love it. I love it because I think, you know, unless you're in grief, you don't understand it. I didn't understand it. I have a sister whose husband died 15 years ago. And I was compassionate, but I didn't really understand why it took so long. That I do. And I don't think you understand how profound it is and how much it affects every facet of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And how we have to pull our lives together and integrate the grief so that we can live life. Because I think too many people get stuck and can't see a way forward. And they're stuck in the past. They're stuck in my husband, my daughter, my child. It's all heartbreaking. And yet it's a normal part of our lives that we have to somehow acknowledge that it's the cycle of life and death. It's going to happen. Sometimes it happens way too early when you feel it absolutely shouldn't. It happens late. My mother died at 93 of COVID a couple of years ago. And I still grieved because I loved her. Just because she's older doesn't mean I don't grieve. She had a long life. Your daughter had a short life. So I think we have to come to that place of it's going to happen. So how can we allow it, but how can we expand our life around it? And that's the work, isn't it?
It is work. But I think the more we accept that death is going to be a part of our lives, whether it be our own death or the fact that if we live long enough, we're going to experience the loss of the loss of others. The more we can make space for that, the better able we're going to be to integrate those losses into our lives and and accept that death is going to be part of our lives. And acceptance doesn't mean closure to a life. It means that I realize that my life is different because the loved ones that I care about are no longer physically present in my life, but I'm willing to re-engage in life nonetheless.
Yeah, I think it's an openness to re-engaging in life. And that takes courage. I think it takes courage to step my... Brian used to have this lovely saying, you know, I can remember when I first met him having piano lessons. And I'm, you know, I have my diploma for teaching piano. So, you know, I could already play classical. And I said to him, you know, I don't know, after a couple of lessons, how long till I can play jazz? Thinking it wouldn't be long because I already played. And he said, well, you'll improve by the thickness of a sheet of paper. I thought, oh, but I love that because I used to use it with my patients, you know, with back pain or how long will it take? And I'd say, well, you know, it'll improve by the thickness of a sheet of paper. And if you get enough sheets, you get a chapter, then you get a book. And it's the same with grief. I wrote a poem of thickness of a sheet of paper. It is so small, but we have to move into that forward direct. We have to be open to it. We have to be brave enough to take the steps, to go to the shops when we would rather stay in bed, to call a friend when we'd rather be alone, to talk about our loved ones. We have to do these things to get back to life because, and I'm pretty passionate about this bit, we're privileged to still have a life. Mm-hmm. Our loved ones don't have that life. We do. So how can we live it to the fullest we are able?
You know, I saw a meme somewhere, I think it was from a Facebook page called Let the Wolves Run Free. And it went something like this, that we are given a life. It is neither good or bad. And essentially the message is it's up to us to determine whether our life is going to be good or bad. And there's a lot of wisdom in that.
There is.
We can be overwhelmed and victimized by the challenges that are ultimately going to find us, or we can empower ourselves to transcend those challenges and live the life of our own choosing, recognizing that it's going to be permanently changed going forward.
Yeah, I think so. You know, when people say, oh, are you back to normal? You know, for grieving, you're not going to go back to normal. It's a new normal. It's different. And I think that's something people don't understand. Generally, society doesn't understand. It puts pressure on the griever, doesn't it, to try and get back and to not process those emotions. But there is a new normal. There is a new life. There is an opportunity to have joy and meaning in life. But you do have to do that grief work, that emotional work, that inner self-discovery, right?
Yep. And whether we experience loss or not, the process of inner self-discovery is always going to be ongoing. There's going to be something that happens in our lives, whether it be challenges on the job, in our relationships, that are going to cause us to go within, reflect, and determine what type of a life do I want to lead now moving forward. There's always going to be some type of transition. It doesn't necessarily have to be related to loss, but there's always going to be some type of transition or challenge that we are going to need to respond to determine what's our life going to look like moving forward. And ultimately, it'll be different than the life that we were previously living because challenge and transition tends to change the trajectory of our life paths.
Yes, it does. It does. Now, I know one of the things you said was, would I read a poem from each of the sections of the book? Would you like me to do that?
Oh, I would love you to do that. And whatever you want to share after you've read that poem, either why you shared that poem or why that poem spoke to you for this particular podcast, any other meetings. I'm just going to leave it up to you. I'm just going to sit back and with the rest of our listeners, just listen to your read.
Okay.
And reflect.
All right. So this is called You're Doing So Well. And it's from the first section, When You're Shattered. You're doing so well. Ah, but I'm not. Do you mean that I'm a quiet griever? That I shield you from my tears, from the uncomfortableness of it all? Do you mean that I'm keeping it together, that I look fine, that I don't talk about it, that I'm back to normal? I'm not. Do you mean I'm strong, not showing any emotion, appearing to be coping just fine? are not. You see, grief is not supposed to be done in silence, in the shadow of your home. It's not meant to be done behind a veil where you can't express your sorrow. Am I doing well? No. I just know that others can't cope if I mourn openly, shed tears, break down. The grief is still taboo. And so I go home, and there I collapse, the burden of the facade finally allowed to let go. And I chose that one because so many people would say, oh, you're so strong, Carol. I needed to smack them. No, I'm just quiet. I'm very English and I don't express my emotions out to you, but I'm dying inside. And so often people say, how are you? Oh, you're doing so well. What does that mean, you're doing so well in grief? So that was my thought process as I wrote that. It's like, you know what? Doing so well means perhaps you're not showing us any of these emotions and it's all comfortable for us and it's not comfortable for the griever. And we feel we have to put on this facade. And I would come home having put on a facade at work because, of course, I'd walk into a room with a patient. I have to be upbeat. They are there in my care. And so I would be present for my patients and I would come home absolutely exhausted from that facade. And I kept that going for 3 years till I burnt out. And then I realized we can't keep this up any longer. So that was an important one for me, I think, for grievers to know that, or for people who aren't grieving to know, don't just say, you're so strong. You don't know what's going on.
No, and I think a lot of times, and I can speak for myself, I put on this public face. To compartmentalize my grief and just to give myself a break from the intense pain that I felt after my daughter transitioned. And a lot of people will say, well, you're so strong. Well, not that I have a choice.
I didn't have a choice. What do you do, curl up and die myself and not come out of my house? And I know that some people almost go into that.
Yeah, and they do. And I think, in the beginning of grief, you have to allow the emotions to affect you. You have to feel it. But if you choose not to move past that, then you're staying stuck. And then we're looking at some long-term complications, probably physical as well as mental health complications.
Totally. I'm just going to throw out a statistic here for your listeners that 10% of psychiatric illnesses have been attributed to unresolved grief.
Mm-hmm.
So for anybody listening, don't push your emotions down. You need to feel it to heal it.
And you don't necessarily have to cry to feel it. You just have to find some way to get it out.
Yes.
You know, whether it's journaling, whether it's just telling the universe that today I'm angry, today I'm sad. You don't necessarily measure a person's degree of emotionality due to the amount of tears that they shed.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, and for me, This writing the poetry was my way of expressing my emotions. Mm. So as you say, journaling, poetry, music. Perhaps you want to go to a musical instrument if you're a musician and play. I felt that had been taken away from me because I couldn't sound the piano. Of course, Brian was a pianist. It might be sitting in nature and just contemplating and being quiet. So many ways. So I'm going to go into the next bit, which is in pieces. And this one is called Transforming Your Relationship. Ah, how you loved with deep soul connection, an ease of being together that felt so glorious, you don't want to let it go. Nor should you. But the beauty of love is that it doesn't stop after your loved one has died. You remain, the love remains, and now the transforming of your relationship begins. That bond is still present, just different. An invisible tether linking you, a continuation of your relationship, but without the physical. How, you may ask? Perhaps you're not spiritual. Perhaps that you think death is it. And that's okay. But the continuing bond can be from talking and sharing about them, about beautiful memories you created together, photos you look at. You choose how to create your transformed relationship. But know this, in doing so, Ease some of the loss and pain and soothe your broken heart. And I pick that because one of the things I talk about in my program is how do we integrate grief, move forward without losing connection to our loved ones? Because I think people sometimes are a little scared to take those steps forward because they think, A, they're dishonoring their loved one, or they'll forget them, or I can't let some of that grief go and move that way because, well, what if? And I want to say you can create, you can maintain your relationship. My love for Brian is as strong as when he was here. It will always be there. My love for my mother, my love for my cat that I had to have put down. It doesn't matter. You can, the love remains. How do you choose to keep that connection? Is it through music? Is it through, or, you know, having a great scrapbook, photo album, talking about them? There are so many different ways, aren't there, Dave, to keep the connection.
Absolutely. And you know, that poem spoke to my heart and to my philosophy is that transforming the relationships with our loved ones, creating continued bonds with their memories, with their essence, are going to allow us to integrate their grief, our grief, and allow us to move forward with them as partners in the life that we now choose to live. We'll maintain connection with the memories of their loved ones, or with the essence of their loved ones and communities that support it. And we actually integrate our grief by remembering, not compartmentalizing it, not grieving for a predetermined amount of time, burying our grief and then moving forward as if nothing had happened. It's maintaining those continued bonds for as long as we are alive that are going to allow us to continue to move through grief. And that's one of the reasons that poem spoke to me when you were reading it, because it you know, mirrors my philosophy of what we need to do to integrate grief following the deaths of our loved ones.
I think so. I think it's so important. And I was talking to a client the other day who doesn't believe that there's any hereafter or transitioning, which is of course fine. That's her belief. But I wanted to give her comfort, and I said, you know, The Grieving Brain, the book by Dr. Mary Frances O'Connell, is a wonderful book, and it talks about how when you have a loved one, they have a neuronal map in your brain, like an avatar of them in your brain. And I said, you know, he may be physically gone, but there are actually circuits in your brain of him still. So he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
She found so much comfort in that. And I think it's really a fascinating thing to learn about this stuff, to learn that actually we have a brain map of every part of our body. That's why when people have an amputation, maybe they've had an amputated hand, they can come in and say, but I still feel my thumb, it's still painful. Well, because the brain hasn't got used to the fact that that part isn't there, there's still a map. And your brain still has this map of your loved one. Mm-hmm. It does sometimes feel like an amputation when they're gone. They're still there in your brain, and it remains, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things about not only my daughter, but my other ancestors who have transitioned from this life. I can remember certain events that we shared as if they were happening in real time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the process, I think, of being able to our brains to store both short and long-term memory, and that we can access those to pretty much at any times, or if just something happens spontaneously or in our environment, or we hear a song, that can really just, I think, stimulate a lot of nostalgia for the people that were in our lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the final one I pick is from the very last section, Making Broken Beautiful. There were so many I could pick, but I picked this one. The grief remains, but you expand around it. It is always there, this loss. How could it not be when your loved one is no longer with you? At first, the grief consumed you. Everything and every moment of life reminded you of their absence. You couldn't imagine that it would ever feel better, not even a bit. And yet, as time went by, little things started to spark some joy. You'd find yourself smiling more often, even laughing out loud. And then a grief burst might arrive, triggered by a scent or a sound, reminding you once more that your grief is there, under the surface, but there nevertheless. The grief didn't change. It remained. But you? You changed. You started to live again. You accepted that grief would be your companion, not your master. And as you allowed yourself to expand around that cold ball of grief, life became more bearable, even pleasurable once more.
Yeah, I like it.
Thank you. Again, for me, it's that imagining, you know, there's your grief and there's your life initially in early grief, but the grief doesn't change. You just kind of expand around it because it's always there. How can it not be? But it doesn't have to. Think my message is it does not have to define the rest of your life. You carry it. It comes. It whispers to you. It talks to you. But it isn't your master. Don't let it be your master and ruin the life you have left.
And the experiences that shape us are both good, what we see as good and what we also see as bad. And if we, in later grief, if we allow the pain that we experience from grief to teach us, to inform us, to make us more aware, there's nothing wrong with that. But in the beginning, we run away from it like it was a bear chasing us in the woods.
It's understandable that people push it down and try and ignore it. I mean, I could read a million poems in there, but it as we allow it, it diffuses it. When you resist it, mm-hmm. persists. And so I think it's that. And it's not easy to sit with these emotions. That's why it's good to have guidance and have tools so that you learn how to sit with it, how to be mindful with it and allow it.
Well, particularly depending on, you know, what aspect of society you believe in or follow, there's always been this prevailing attitude that emotions get in the way of productivity, get in the way of success, get in the way of happiness, where in reality, embracing our emotions make us more genuine and I think make us more successful and make us more whole.
And that, I mean, that sits with the, 3 to 5 days bereavement leave here in Ontario. How on earth are you supposed to go back to work in that time frame? I went back 3 days after Brian's funeral. Stupid. Didn't know any better. And how can anybody be expected to be a surgeon, be an accountant, be a lawyer, whatever it is, in a high-powered job with numbers, with people's lives in their hands, 3 to 5 days after, say, their husband or wife died or child? You're not functioning. You are not functioning on all cylinders, nor can you.
No, grief has a pervasive effect on us physically, cognitively, emotionally, socially, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading somewhere where the chance of a heart attack increases significantly within the first 24 hours after a significant death.
There's something called, it's Takotsubo syndrome. There's broken heart syndrome. We've all heard of an older couple, you know, they've been married for 60 years. One dies and a day or two later, the other one dies. And we all go, oh, with broken heart. Yes. The left ventricle expands like an octopus catching pock, which is the Takotsubo pock, and they die. I was speaking to my sister a couple of days ago, and her husband died very suddenly. She said that night the chest pain was so severe, I thought I was going to die, and I didn't care right at that moment. I said, yeah, I get that. So, you know, it's very common to have chest palpitations and chest pain after your loved one's died. Yeah, get it checked out, anybody listening, obviously. But it is, It can give you a heart attack.
And I think a lot of times, too, it's also, you know, we have increased blood pressure, higher stress levels, I think increased blood clotting, all of that, I think, contributes to the risk of heart attack. And that can, not only within the first 24 hours, but that can last up to about a week after that person has died. So, yeah, it's always good to get checked out and good to be aware of that. And that's why it's really important to try to do self-care throughout the grief journey.
Yeah.
But thank you for reading those three poems. I'll tell you, I've got your book. I've read the book. It's a great book of poetry. If you love poetry or are looking for another creative outlet for your grief, get Kintsugi Your Heart, The Art of Living with Grief. I'd highly recommend it to my listeners that you purchase it. It's a great book, and You can really just resonate with there's so much in there. You can just pick and choose what you resonate with, but guaranteed there's going to be something for everybody in that book. So I would encourage everybody out there to go ahead and pick up a copy. And I'm sure Carol will tell us later how we can do that. So, but one of my last questions for you today is that if you're going to leave our listeners with one thing today, what would that be, Carol?
I hate it when it's one thing.
Well, I want to interject. You can make it two things because this is your platform.
Okay, my platform. I think first is to understand that grief is a whole body experience. Understand that because I didn't know that. You know, it's going to affect your mind, body, soul, spirit. And there are all sorts of odd physical things, physiological things happening. So, you know, the heart and all of that. And I think the other one is to give yourself permission to grieve. Take the time that you need. Don't rush back to work. If you can, I know sometimes we can't. I know sometimes we have younger children or older parents. But if you can find the time, and that may be if you're a very busy person, taking 15 minutes out of the day, twice a day, to sit and contemplate, to allow yourself to cry, to think. But give yourself time to feel the emotions because you have to feel them. I think that's really important.
You're right. And I know there's a line that I like to quote from the movie, The Fault of Our Stars, where one of the protagonists who is dying from cancer says, pain demands to be felt. And boy, pain does demand to be felt because if we don't allow it us to feel it, it's just gonna follow us until we make friends with it or until we learn how to manage it.
It is. And I think that the lesson from this is you can push it down and go, no, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. That energy of pain, that energy of grief sits in your body and it's going to cause other physical, we've already said, mental issues, and it will explode on you when you least expect it. So better to have that courage to take the time and be with it as you can and get guidance for it. Get support. Get the right support would be the third thing, obviously.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%, probably even 1,000% on that one. So, but anyway, Carol, my last question for you is if people want to get in touch with you, want to contract with you for your services, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do all of that?
Go to my website. All my socials are on there. There's a form you can email me from there. So if you're struggling, just email me. We can talk. You can schedule a call with me. It's all on the website. The book's available on Amazon in paperback, Kindle, and on Audible. The website, carolbannons.com, nice and easy. Everything's available on there. But do reach out. If you're struggling, reach out for a chat. We can talk.
Thank you, Carol. And thank you for being such a valuable guest contributor today on the Teaching Journeys podcast. I enjoyed our conversation. I know we're going to do this again next year.
We are. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dave. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you, Carol. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.